Hey, and welcome to Things Worth Learning. I'm your host, Matt Stauffer. This is a show where a curious computer programmer, that's me, interviews fascinating people about their passions. My guest today is Justin Jackson, co-founder of the podcast hosting service Transistor and the creator of about a jillion products and podcasts targeting entrepreneurs and founders. Justin, hey, would you mind telling the audience a little bit about yourself and whether it's your personal or your professional life?
Yeah, I mean, I work at Transistor full-time now. I've been interested in entrepreneurship for a long time. I'm a dad of four kids. My wife and I just celebrated our 20th anniversary.
Congratulations, man. That's huge.
Yeah, it's big. It wasn't, whenever I talk about that part, I'm like, it wasn't easy.
Right.
It's like not all those years were
good.
But
that's why it's huge, because you made it.
And something that a lot of people don't know about me is that I came into tech late in life, 28 years old. The first kind of decade of my life, I was evangelical youth minister and left that world behind in 2008 when I worked for a software company, and that's kind of defined me since then. But I had this prior life that nobody knows about. That one of the first... What is it? You get three decades or something?
I think it's, yeah, it's something like, I wish I could remember how they split it up, but yes, that was your first chunk, right?
That was my first chunk, yeah.
Which is funny, because that's my first chunk too, was I was an evangelical campus minister for the first chunk.
Yeah.
Went back to software.
I remember chatting with you about that at a conference, like we were at a speaker's dinner.
Yep.
And it's a part of my life I don't get to talk about very much. And so when I sat down with you and... you revealed that about yourself, there was definitely this like safety and also just yearning to be able to talk to somebody about those things. And maybe we can get into that a bit later. I don't even really exactly know where how post-evangelical you are. So
yeah, man, maybe I'll be revealing it all this podcast. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it is important to talk about because North America has this strong Christian, evangelical, Catholic, Episcopal background, context for decades. And so it's built into the fabric of especially the United States. Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of people who might have similar experiences or struggles or questions. So yeah, I think it might be interesting to chat. Let's
take us somewhere. And we are both people who've been trying to talk publicly about mental health and stuff like that. So turns out this is connected. And it might be helpful to talk about this publicly too. So
totally. Yeah. About half my time in therapy is just exploring stuff related to religion and that whole experience. So
Well, clearly we're gonna get there. So thank you for that intro. I'm gonna ask you one question and then we'll get right into it. So the one question is, do you have any sort of life mantra or phrase or idea you try to live your life by?
Yeah. So the most poignant for me is this quote from James Clear: every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become. No single instance will transform your beliefs, but as votes build up, so does the evidence of your identity. This is why habits are crucial. They cast repeated votes for being a type of person. And so for me, especially going through different seasons of life, and that includes kind of spirituality and religion, but also career, also relationships, also depression, also, you know, whatever it is, I've found that quote to be incredibly helpful because in the moments where I felt like, I don't know, a shitty dad, I could look at that quote and go, okay, well, what's just one vote I can take that will be evidence that I can be a better dad. And it's like, okay, well, I'm tired, but I can take the kids to the trampoline and jump on the trampoline with them. And it was just a small thing, but it became a vote for the kind of person I wanted to be.
That's so cool, man.
So yeah, I've referred back to that. Josh Pigford has a service that will print your tweets out on wood. Yeah. And I've printed James Clear's tweet out on engraved in wood and have it in our house because it's been so kind of central for me.
That is really cool. I love that idea about the vote for the person you want to be, especially when you're doubting the person you think you are. I mean, obviously, you and I have an ongoing dialogue about, you know, depression and anxiety and handling them and stuff like that. But I do think that, like, especially in the context of wrestling with our identity after being in a place that kind of provided us a lot of identity, as we're about to talk about, being in a place where you now have to figure out your own identity. Again, I don't want to go too deep in the actual topic yet, but, like, I can really see the value in learning how to, like, determine your own identity, I guess, like, have agency over it.
Yeah. I think this is also why one of tech, like the tech industry that I'm in now, one of the problems is it's, I mean, even our pop culture is, it's really focused on young people, folks in their 20s, you know, startup founders, you know, the hot startup founders are in their 20s. Yeah. A lot of the crypto community right now is in their 20s.
Or teens.
or teens. And there's nothing wrong with being in your teens or your 20s. It's an awesome time. For me, you know, life got difficult in my 30s and now 40s. There's challenge there that you don't get, or most, a lot of people don't get when you're kind of in the, again, it's a great stage, that idealistic stage of being in your 20s. But having older people who can talk openly that life is not just idealistic clouds and rainbows is very important for the culture. And I wish I knew more people, older people, who had revealed this to me, who had been transparent about it, because I felt like I just kind of lived in this state of, you know, like public politeness, where everybody just seems to have their shit together and
everything's fine.
And everything's
too blessed
fine.
To be stressed.
And to emphasize this even more, like, when hard stuff started happening to me, again, relationships, family, kids, whatever it is, it felt like it was so outside of what was quote unquote normal that I really thought I was a deviant. I thought I I had deviated from what was normal and healthy because it just seemed like everybody was walking around with this kind of public persona that's just, that denies, you know, and kind of looks down on things like that. I often go back to, like, the Britney Spears thing, like when she was going through some stuff and it was in the media. I remember everybody kind of around me being like, whoa, like, Britney's crazy, you know? And then in my 30s and 40s, I've identified with that person, that Britney, a lot more, going, that's like, people go through that. And it was odd for me to have people around me treat it as so deviant when it's like the disruption in my own life has almost matched that. And to not have that echoed or mirrored amongst anybody is just like, ugh, like, why doesn't that exist?
Yeah. Which is why, and again, then we'll go right into the topic. It was one of the benefits of just being able to be open and honest about these things that seem to be taboo to talk about, right? Because you know, like, I know we have both benefited from other people who've been public about their stories and their histories, and then it allows us to be public about ours. So,
yes, absolutely.
All right. So let's get to the primary topic, because obviously we're already on the verge of it from, like, six different angles already. You know, this topic is about, our podcast is about one topic you're really passionate about. Could you tell me, what are we going to talk about today?
I think post-evangelicalism is the topic, and what my thoughts, experiences, lessons, and thoughts about leaving the church, leaving faith, of taking something that was central to my identity for the first three decades of my life, and actually central to my family's identity, and then moving on, how that happens, and then what happens after is something that doesn't get talked a lot about. And that term post-evangelical can mean different things for different people. For some people, it means they've left faith entirely, and that would be where I sit. For some people, it means they've left evangelicalism in particular, and maybe they've gone back to a more traditional or liturgical church or something like that. And for the purposes of this conversation, evangelicalism, I would define it as a brand of Christianity, fairly modern, with the, it has, it's like the, in its extreme form, it's the church you see on TV.
Right.
It's the Joel Osteen. It's mega churches. It's political lobby groups and organizations like Focus on the Family. Mm-hmm. It's mission trips. It's outreach, you know, Christian outreach to teenagers and college students primarily. It's that whole thing. And would you define it any other way? Would you add or subtract from that, do you think?
Yeah, there's a tiny little bit of like more theological space, just in case anybody like has a theological bent. Evangelicalism came out of fundamentalism in the early like 20s and 30s. And fundamentalism at that point didn't mean what it means now. It just meant we want to go back to the fundamentals. And evangelicalism kind of defined itself. I think the way they talked about it was like Billy Graham and then John Stott, but a guy basically in the UK and Billy Graham were kind of like the two global spearheads. And they defined it in a book called Evangelical Truth that was basically you've got evangelicalism, you've got mainline Protestantism, and then you've got Catholicism. And that's kind of how they saw it. And obviously, there's way more than that. But in their mind, the mainline, which is like the, if you look at all like the Presbyterians and Methodists and all that kind of stuff, usually there's one half of those denominations that are like, you know, LGBTQ plus affirming and women priests. And then there's usually one half of each of those that's like not. So the ones that are not are the evangelicals. The ones that are the mainline. And then you've got Catholic. And of course, there's a lot of other denominations in there. But historically, it's been the majority of like North American white Christian religion that isn't either progressive or Catholic or super fringe, right? So all the non-denominationals tend to be evangelical, Baptist, evangelical, you know, all the big people you see. So that's the only thing I would add to it. So,
yes. And maybe not most importantly, but crucially for people like you and I and a lot of people listening, is that it's the most, it was very strong. It has a strong culture that intersected with capitalism and politics and media. Yeah. And we grew up, I was born in 1980. Mm-hmm. I grew up when this was happening. So Christian bookstores and music stores in every city in North America, media properties like VeggieTales and Christian music and Christian concerts, Christian movies. It was the first time really where Christians had their own culture and that meant their own media, that meant their own magazines, that meant you could grow up and you had an alternative to whatever was not Christian and not church. And it was a way of, you know, parents kind of protecting their kids, you know? Mm-hmm. And I definitely grew up that way of,
me too.
You know, I wasn't allowed to, my kids think this is hilarious, but I was not allowed to watch the Smurfs, wasn't allowed to watch, what was it, Ghostbusters? We just watched Ghostbusters the other day. But I was allowed to, you know, get anything I wanted from the Christian bookstore. And, you know, we would visit frequently, you know, maybe once or twice a month and buy new CDs. You know, I'm really into stand-up comedy. The first stand-up comedy I heard was Mike Warnke. Like, it was like, Mike Warnke was like a former Satanist, quote unquote.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
And stole most of his jokes from like Bill Cosby and like.
Oh my gosh.
But, you know, I remember the odd thing is growing up in that, there's a strange nostalgia that comes with all of that. So the same way people feel about their favorite TV shows and their favorite music and their favorite events or whatever, I still feel, even though I've left the faith, I still feel that towards, like, I have good memories of listening to Mike Warnke tapes on family trips and laughing. I have good memories, even though he's been proven to be a fraud and a huckster since then. My first real business hero was Phil Vischer, the guy that created VeggieTales. He just seemed to be doing everything I wanted to do. He'd created this company. He was making animation. He was having this big impact on the culture. And so there's, for me, one thing I think about a lot is there's really not a lot of public discourse about growing up in that culture because it was at its strongest in the 80s and 90s and is now not as much of a thing, partly because, like, I mean, even streaming has, I think, affected the cultural, like when you had the Christian bookstore, it was like the center of the Christian culture. And you had Focus on the Family had some magazines for teenagers, Breakaway for guys and Brio for girls.
Yeah, Breakaway.
And, you know, that back then you could, the internet was not very big and you could, if you were going to get your kid a magazine subscription, that kind of would dictate the kind of culture they would be exposed to.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot easier back then to say, well, you know, we're a Christian family. We're just going to read these magazines.
Yeah.
We're going to watch these movies. We're going to buy this music.
Yeah.
You want to go to a concert? Who's it with? Where are you going? Oh, it's with the church youth group. Okay, you can go.
Cool.
You know, it was like, it was easy. Mm-hmm. And interesting on all sorts of ways. Like there's bands. Since I've become an adult, I've become friendly with Mike Herrera, who's the lead singer of MXPX.
Really?
Which is like, yeah, which is amazing. Which is like this, it was like kind of in the punk rock section of the Christian bookstore, they were like the big, and they could sell out huge venues and I've talked to him about this a few times. He actually doesn't, he's not a big fan of talking about this connection, but that distribution channel for them was massive. Like it's one of the only times in history where people have had, where bands, for example, have had that kind of distribution. And it allowed a lot of like artistic people to, and creative people to get, you know, some traction and get an audience and build up, you know, a following. And again, I think that's the only time in history that that's really happened.
As long as they behaved, right?
As long as they behaved,
which is, yes. Could be an entirely separate podcast if we wanted.
Yeah. So since I've left that culture, so I worked for a Christian evangelical organization doing events for high school students, camps for high school students. And for me, I moved away from Christianity slowly. It was like nudge by nudge, bit by bit, until one day you wake up and you go, man, I just don't feel like going to church anymore. And then hanging out with different people. So once I was no longer working with Christians, meeting with Christian donors and Christian leaders and Christian small groups, my new social group became like the people I was hanging out with in tech. And one thing I've learned since then is that really we are just a reflection of the people we hang out with.
Come on. That's so much the truth. That's so true.
And that was striking for me at first, because previously I thought, well, no, there's this inspired truth in this book that was written thousands of years ago. And that is what's creating this identity. That's what's informing this belief. But I mean, I could be wrong about everything, but my experience since then is that you just end up reflecting the people you hang out with. And I've had this experience also, even like moving to a new neighborhood or a new town, you just start. I moved from Alberta, which is like the Texas of Canada, to BC, which is like the California, Portland-ish. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
West Seattle. Coast.
Yep.
And just that move nudges me over.
Yeah.
And is when I left and I decided that I was done, I ripped out all of this old stuff, feeling like these were old, useless parts that I no longer needed. So prayer, gone. Traditions, gone. Small groups, gone. You know, just take all these things out.
Yeah.
And let's say that transformation happened between the ages of 28 and 32. From 32 to 40, as I've reflected.
Yeah.
One thing I'm realizing is that some of those things were good things that maybe I shouldn't have thrown away so fast.
Interesting, yeah.
So I'll give you an example. Why pray before a meal if you don't believe in God? Well, it turns out that that practice of like a family gathering together, sitting down together, and there being an official start to the meal where everyone gets grounded, maybe you hold hands, you take a breath, you close your eyes, there's some silence. That act, that tradition, that practice actually has tons of ancillary benefits outside of maybe connecting with a deity that's there.
Yeah.
And we just threw all that stuff out. And in retrospect, I think it caused us to be a little bit rudderless, where the benefit of religion is you have thousands of years of practice. And some of it is not good. Maybe a lot of it is not good. But there are things in it. Some of these practices, some of these traditions are incredibly helpful for human beings, for families, for societies. And by ejecting those, why did I say ejecting like that?
It's because you're Canadian.
By ejecting.
I thought that's how Canadians say it. It's like an adult, eject.
Is it eschewing or eschewing?
Eschewing, I think. I don't actually know. I think it's eschewing. That's how I always said it.
By removing those from our lives, it was like taking these pillars that had always been there and just like, nope, don't need these, and not thinking about whether they were load-bearing walls or not. Just we're taking everything out. And it's been interesting for me to think about that. It also leads to this profound problem that I've heard reflected from other people. I was listening to Noah Kagan. He's the founder of AppSumo. And he said one time, he's like, man, I wish there was a church for atheists. Because he's like, I'd like to go somewhere every Sunday, meet up with people I like, have somebody communicate a message that, you know, is somewhat challenging for my life, and then be able to talk about it afterwards with people over coffee and cookies.
And like, that sounds kind of good.
And again, there's this like period of like, when you leave a religion, I'm sure this is true with any, like, you know, Amish people, anybody that's left this very, this kind of embedded identity that was in religion. And then like, at first, I think it's common to say, well, that was all garbage and I'm never doing that again. And invariably, it's like people come back and go, man, like, I wish there was something for non-religious people or people that are not spiritual in that way, where we could have some of these traditions that really human society has developed over thousands of years and maybe are just good.
Good for us, yeah.
For us. And then it seems like in the pendulum, this is where people end up going back to like what you might call a mainline, like a church with liturgy. So in Canada, that might be like the Anglican church. Like, okay, well, I'm just going to go back to a church where I don't have to be invested spiritually. They're not going to, they're not going to ask me to come on stage and sing with a microphone and a smoke machine. And, you know, but I'm going to be able to sing some hymns. I'm going to be able to be thoughtful. I'm going to be able to have this practice that grounds me. And yeah, it's strange in my in my 40s to, as someone who's been fairly like even my brother, who's this kind of tough biker dude, we were talking about it at some point. I was I'm oldest of four kids, last of the kids to kind of leave the faith. And my brother goes, so you're not spiritual at all? I said, no. He said, that's weird. He's like, that's messed up. But to reflect on it and be like, wow, like I am missing something. And it would be great to sit in a pew. It would be great to sing those songs. That's the other thing. Like if you talk to my wife, I sing hymns all the time. I sing old DC Talk songs all the time. I can't help, I can't help myself. It's super cringy too. Like my kids will hear, what are you singing?
I don't want your sex for now. Not until we take a vow. Some old school stuff right there.
I played a song for my 16-year-old And it's like, it's like Toby Mac is like, yeah, boy.
Oh, God.
And my 16-year-old was like, Dad, this explains so much. He's like, this guy so is corny. You.
Really?
He's like,
that's
this
awesome.
Guy is you. It explains your personality. So there's like some things that I would actually probably like to rid myself of. But on the other hand, maybe I don't. Like my wife asked me why I keep singing hymns. So there's like certain hymns that come back to me. I don't believe in the spiritual significance of them at all, but I do, but I'm coming around to the idea that they're good for my spirit. Mm. And it takes me back to this idea that atheism as a thing, it lacks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It lacks these practices, these traditions, these grounding forces that are really helpful for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real good atheist hymns. Actually, that would be an interesting, that would be, if anyone's listening and they have some good atheist hymns, please send them to me.
Because I actually have heard of somebody who did like a church service for atheists, and I was choosing not to Google it until we finished talking. But now I'm actually very curious to see what else is out there.
Yeah, like what are the practices of, and it goes beyond music. Like, of course, there's incredibly moving secular music.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're missing is this participatory mm-hmm. element.
Yeah, congregational, right? It's like everybody
congregational.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just me. It's not just me listening.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just me listening and singing lyrics to a song because I like the tune or even I like the message. It's this communal togetherness
mm-hmm.
of humans expressing things together.
Yeah.
And there's so many dynamics of that it's hard to explain if you've never experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it, I think, is just theater
that
people of faith put on. But some of it is like you're singing a hymn and the guy behind you, his voice cracks because he's emotional.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like this one little element of that act of singing a hymn, but all of these things are cumulative and add up to an experience that is incredibly profound.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been exploring some of this stuff of like, what can I do now for myself? And then also, what can I do for my family?
Yeah.
And one of the things I've come, and maybe it's why I wanted to talk about it, is one of the conclusions I've come to is that it's very difficult to do anything like this, to build practice in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
You need the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
You need like-minded people coming together for the same reason, and you need it on the rails in the same way that a programming framework puts a programming language on the rails, and it just like, mm-hmm. it's all here. Like,
yeah.
I install Laravel, and it just, up, yep. up, 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 up. It's all yep. there. And the idea of church has all the scaffolding mm-hmm. right there. It's like
that's good work.
An actual, very well thought out. And some of this was done for manipulation. Mm-hmm. Like in youth ministry, we would sing energetic songs at first.
Mm-hmm.
We also understood that like the singing together has other psychological and sociological effects.
Yeah.
That can be used for manipulation.
Yep.
This is the both and, because on the other hand, it can be used for manipulation, but it can also just be good.
Yeah.
This idea of coming together and, you know, most churches follow this kind of, this feeling is you sing the energetic hymns first,
mm-hmm.
and then you have a little interlude, and then you sing a bit slower hymns, and then you have another like scripture reading, and then you sing the really slow kind of thoughtful, mindful. It's all just preparing you mm-hmm. to be in this place where you can receive a message or whatever. Mm-hmm. And again, part of this is manipulation. But looking at it from another perspective, I also am recognizing that now that I've kind of gone through my cynical stage of saying, well, that was really manipulative.
Yeah.
I'm now in the stage beyond that where I'm like, but there's also something really helpful about that, mm-hmm. about going into a place and, you know, you're burdened by the events of the week and by the pains of your present or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you sing something that's really hopeful and triumphant.
Yeah.
And it makes you raise your voice. Even like in psychology, we're learning that the expression of things outwardly, like rage therapy and all these things that people are exploring now, it's all in church, man. It's like, we're going to sing this thing out. You can sing as loud as you want. You can just let it out. And then, okay, now we're going to bring it down a notch. We're going to get a bit more contemplative. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to bring it down a notch. And I mean, in churches with liturgy, this is what people like, is that it's like, dun, da dun, da dun, pause, think, pray, be quiet with your thoughts in the midst of other people being quiet with their thoughts. Okay, now let's pray together. And now let's have a message about something in your life that maybe you need to think about. Mm-hmm. Let me give you some hope. Let me give you some correction. Let me give, you know, like there's something about that that is incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And so in isolation, I've tried to reinvent some of these things. Uh-huh. I think it's actually why people like conferences, you know?
Very interesting.
And I mean, it also explain why, if anyone's heard me speak publicly, if you think of me like a preacher, it makes more sense.
Yeah.
that is what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. That is the way I've been trained, but it's also kind of what I long for. Mm-hmm. Is the talk I gave at the last Laracon in New York was, I think the title was Why Growing Old in Tech is Hard. Mm-hmm. But really it's a sermon about being in your 30s and 40s and how to work through real life struggles, mm-hmm. and maybe how to have some hope at the end of it. And it's just, I mean, it's exactly, not exactly, but it's very similar.
Yeah.
And I do have a concern about this, about the performative nature of preaching. Mm-hmm. So let's just set that aside. But, you know, like I gave that talk and there's a lineup of people that want to talk about it.
Yeah.
The cynical part of me goes, this is just, you're just playing the evangelical playbook and now people are responding. The less cynical part of me goes, but people just need this.
Yeah.
People just need to have a connection with other human beings who are willing to get past the skin level, outward level, surface level stuff and really dig into the guts of pain and joy and triumph and failure. And this is where I'm at today. And we need it. Like we actually probably do need it weekly. Mm-hmm. And then when we get it from a conference talk or we get it from one of the new, what do you call a bad preacher? You know, like the Tony Robbins of the world, you know, like the
prosperity theology, televangelism. Yeah, shysters.
Like, yeah.
Oh, but Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins is not a preacher, though, right? Isn't he a motivational speaker? Okay.
Yeah, motivational speaker. But I think the longing, what people go to Tony Robbins for, is this thing. And I think what I'm saying is, I think, and I could be wrong because this is just where I'm at in my state of life. Again, having left faith, having then been cynical about faith and completely cast it off, and now getting back to this point where I'm like, maybe there's something here.
Yeah.
And then going through the process of being cynical again, and I'm like, well, I don't want to be like Tony Robbins, but then moving even past that and going, but there is a good version of this. And what is it? What's the best form for it? And if human culture really is not that old, it's like maybe thousands of years old, really. I think the oldest traditions we have are, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 years old, something like that. Maybe older. I don't know.
I don't know. What would you say? I mean, I know that there's a lot of things where like this thing was invented in often China or the Middle East hundreds of thousands of years ago. So I imagine there's some, but I do know that the majority of Western culture starts within the last 3,000 to 4,000 years. So
yeah, so thinking like if in the context of the universe, if humans have the human society has the possibility of existing for hundreds of thousands of years or even millions of years, we're still very early.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if there's going to be a big group of people, and again, maybe faith like is just so useful. Like there's definitely days I wish I could go back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm guessing there will always be a place for people who are religious and spiritual, and mm-hmm. it will continue to serve them in the ways I'm describing. But my guess is that as human society progresses, there's going to be a big group of people who are atheists. And what are the practices, the cultural things we need to set in motion now so that in hundreds of years or thousands of years, we have this scaffolding for mm-hmm. people who might choose to be this way?
Yeah.
And I think part of me gets hopeful about that because it feels mm-hmm. like it's possible. And in North America especially, but most of Western culture, this is fairly recent. Mm-hmm. This movement, like church attendance, like traditional church attendance is in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, is decreasing. So, mm-hmm. but it's fairly recent that this has happened, right?
Yeah.
So what are we going to do for all those folks that have left? And I think it's going to require some experimentation in my own household, but mm-hmm. there's going to need to be connection mm-hmm. in where instead of atheism being or non-belief or post-evangelicalism or whatever camp you're in being this very private thing mm-hmm. that we don't talk about, mm-hmm. where, you know, even talking about some of the stuff like singing DC Talk songs is so embarrassing. But at the same time, again, like, where's the spaces to do this?
Yeah.
I think the stage we're at now, we require more connection. There needs to be people reaching out saying, hey, you know, this is what we're doing. Hey, you know, even every Saturday morning when I can, I walk down to this coffee shop and I text message a few people and we get together and we just talk about mm-hmm. intellectual stuff, about life stuff, about whatever. It's like a small group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that act is so helpful.
Yeah.
And when I do it, even though it feels like a small vote for, you know, something bigger,
yeah.
It makes me feel like it's building up to something better, a new scaffolding, new rails that maybe I won't fully benefit from, but maybe my kids will benefit from and their kids after that. Looking again at all these things that we grew up with and separating the good from the bad and saying, you know what, this practice was actually very good.
Yeah.
How can we incorporate that into our context in a way that matters?
That was incredible. I have so few questions to ask. I have so few contributions to make. I'm like, well, wrapping up. And since we are late on time, I want to add one little note that you don't need to respond to, but I want to note that like my particular place of post-evangelicalism is I still have faith, but I don't believe that the evangelical, like the white evangelical church is a good and healthy thing for faith or for non-faith. So mm-hmm. I'm, you know, some people would say I'm ex-evangelical, but I have lots of feelings about all those things that I will not talk about now. But a lot of the needs that I feel are very similar to the ones that you feel. Because I can't mm-hmm. find a church that I feel super comfortable attending. I can't find a church I feel comfortable taking my black children to that I don't think there's going to be weird white supremacy issues that are going to be embedded in weird political things. You know what I mean? Like there's so mm-hmm. many aspects here where I miss a lot of those same things that you do, right?
Yeah.
And so while some of them are a little bit easier for me, like I can still pray before dinner with the kids and it's not weird. And I talk about faith with my kids and they say, well, does this exist or does that exist? And I'm like, well, Daddy thinks this, but he's not sure. Mommy, I think she thinks that, but you can go ask her. And other people think other things, and we're all going to have to figure out on our own. You know, and sometimes we'll say, here's some things that I think everybody in your life believes. For example, we talk to them about the ancestors, and that's something that's, you know, common across a lot of religions and also common across a lot of Black cultures. Talking about the fact that, like, your ancestors, we believe, still are in a place where after death, they can see you, they can be a part of life, your life, they care for you, they root for you, whatever. We believe that we're going to see them after death. That's not something that we're saying is absolutely true, but your mom believes it, your dad believes it, your aunts and uncles believe it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people in the world believe it. So if that makes sense to you, then you can choose to believe that too. So we have space for some of these conversations that are a little bit easier, because while I'm not in evangelicalism, I still get some of these faithy benefits, but there's still a lot of ways where I resonated so much with what you said of, like, I still miss. And, you know, like, I've got a mastermind group with that's kind of like a small group. And I've got a group with a couple neighbors that I meet with together once a month to talk about our finances. And we have meals afterwards, and they're, you know, one of their daughters make me little, we love you, Mr. Matt cards. And it feels like a small group. So I'm like getting a lot of those moments in my life where it's like, oh yeah, I miss this.
Yeah.
So I feel you, dude.
And to not, again, I think the state I'm at now is to not be ashamed of some of those impulses.
Right.
Or not even to be ashamed to borrow some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And also not to be ashamed. Like, there are some high school students that I was a big part of their life. I was a big mentor for them. Mm-hmm. And now they're grown up and they have families. And I couldn't talk to them for years. And finally giving myself the permission to be like, it's okay to still connect with these people.
Yeah. I love that.
And it's okay to be acknowledging that some of these desires you have are just good desires for community, for connection, for tradition, for daily, weekly, monthly, seasonal practice. And to see the evidence of that, like Christmas and Halloween and Easter. Like, these are just religious holidays that have been turned into secular traditions. And there's a reason why we did that. It's like, it's because there's something helpful about them. That the practice is actually perhaps the most important part of it. That the feelings that we get aren't just like throwaway feelings, but the feelings of warmth and family and food and, you know, nostalgia from when you were a kid. These are all actually things that we need.
And it's okay to want them and seek them, right?
It's like, okay to want them and seek them, even if you are leaving behind some things from the past, and especially if you're leaving behind some of the truly toxic things in the culture that needed to be called out. There's some of that stuff that just needed to be called out, but again, there's some of that practice that was good. And so, I think it's okay to recognize that.
I love that. First of all, thank you. Everything you just said was amazing and insightful, and I really appreciate your openness.
Cathartic for me. Thanks for listening.
Of course. And as always, I could talk to you about this for like another 3 more hours, but time limits and everything. But I was going to say, it's also okay, and it's not shameful to go get those things from religious spaces if you're not in a religious space. Like, I am not an Anglican, and I would have no qualms whatsoever with going and sitting in an Anglican church and receiving what benefit I can from there. And to be honest, I don't know any Anglicans that would be like, uh-oh, there's an atheist in the pews. There's a guy who doesn't know what his faith is and so doesn't go to church in the pews. They'd be like, cool, you want to listen to God? We're here for it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think anybody has any issue that if anybody's in any space and they want to go participate in those things for whatever reason, I'm always going to hold it against you, you know?
Yeah, and this is the... Again, there's the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church and a lot of Lutheran Church. You know, they have a lot of bad history. There's some bad stuff in there. But that doesn't mean that necessarily that it's a bad idea to go to one of these incredible cathedrals and sit down and benefit somewhat from that environment. Of course, if you were truly traumatized, then that wouldn't be a good experience. But I think some of that exploration is good. I like that addition. And maybe I will. Maybe I will. My parents would be delighted.
That's the thing. I'm like, you could say, I am an atheist. I'm going to go sit in this church for atheist reasons. And all the Christians in your life will still be like, ooh.
They'd be excited.
And I mean, yes. I'm speaking to myself as much. Like I've not left the faith, but I have not found places other than friend relationships where I feel like I have like space for spirituality. And so there's been a lot of me that just keeps going, can I go to a place that either just for me or even me, for me and my kids, that I don't think is toxic. And maybe mm-hmm. we have to have conversations about it afterwards, but at least brings something into their lives and gives them some opportunity to make their own decisions versus me making them all for them. Right. So like, it's just, it's, there's no hard and fast. I mean, and you mentioned like, you felt like you had a hard and fast rule for close to a decade of, I just can't touch that stuff. And it sounds like a lot of what you're saying right now is, you know what, like I can figure out what's good for me. You know, I can figure out what I need. And sometimes it looks like those things that I ran away from.
Sure. This new reality is definitely a lot messier. It was a lot easier for my Turns parents out. And my parents' parents when it was just, it was the it, easy. It's just the script is there.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we can't like engage with the mess and figure some stuff out. And maybe what mm-hmm. comes out is something really good.
Yeah. I love that. All right. To keep us from talking any further, last question. What insight or support did you receive or need when you were younger that you hope more people will give to others today?
I mean, this is where I think the model, especially in evangelicalism, the way, this is not universal, I'll just talk about my experience, but the way I got taken care of from leaders and mentors, it wasn't all good advice they gave me, but there's no doubt that I would not be the person I am today if it wasn't for a lot of that care. And for me, the the messy example of this is, you know, in 2016 or 17, I went through this truly traumatic experience. And an old Christian mentor called me just to see if I could fix his website. And I have had a real hard time with this guy since leaving the faith. Like his Facebook posts and political beliefs are heinous to me. Yeah. Like I cannot stand what he says.
Yeah.
But he instantly recognized that something was wrong and cared for me and really loved me in a genuine way, in a sacrificial way. Gave hours and hours of his time, took it upon himself to call back every week to see how I was doing. And it's possible that I would have done something very destructive to myself if he hadn't stepped in. And so I bring that up partly because online, this guy's a cartoon of the most, like some of the most despicable stuff.
Yeah.
And, but, personally, I'm saying, and there was nothing, I know some people might could be cynical about this. There was nothing unhealthy about the care he showed for me, or it's not like he had any sort of power over me or anything like that. I'm telling you, this was as genuine as anything you've experienced. And that to me, is important. And I think the way the way that mentorship and leadership worked for me, there's also a lot of abuse for others in this scenario, but the way it worked for me was really profound and genuine and pure. Even though, you know, some of the stuff they said I think was not right, even though, you know, maybe they pumped me up a bit too much. Maybe they gave me too much of an ego. There were some downsides, but there's a lot of that was just very healthy.
Yeah.
And when I look at my own kids, I'm like, man, there's just times I wish there was other adults in their lives besides me that cared for them in that way. Mentors, leaders, you know, trusted adults that can help kind of guide them along the way. So that's something that I'll never forget. And it's also the thing that I'm I think about in terms of like, as parents, we are so limited. you can do the best job you can, but you really do need other people, other community, other adults that care about your kids. And, I think it's important. And yeah, for sure, I would not be here unless I had that.
Love that. It takes a village to raise a child, right?
Yeah. 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 It's true.
Well, I've said this already, but this was freaking brilliant. I look forward to having you on again. Next time we'll talk crypto. But thank
that will be the full arc, yeah, is going from evangelicalism to the modern atheistic religions, which is crypto. I cannot wait to talk about that.
I'm looking forward to it, man.
Have me back. And also, if people have some atheist hymns they want to send me, please. Yeah. DM me.
Well, perfect timing, because I was going to say, how can people follow you? How can they support you? So where do they send it? Where are you? If people wanted to pay you money, just tell us about your stuff.
Sure. I mean, if you're into podcasting, go to transistor.fm. Mm-hmm. My blog is justinjackson.ca, where I write about business 80% of the time and this personal life stuff about 20% of the time. Maybe mm-hmm. I'll change that. And Twitter, I'm the letter M, the letter I, Justin, M-I, Justin.
I learned the story of why you're M.I. Justin. It was delightful. I'm Stouffer Matt because I was an idiot and got some stupid acronym when Twitter started. And by the time I realized I wanted Matt Stouffer, some guy had taken it and is squatting on it. And so I'm still fighting him trying to get it. So
if we could go back, if we could go back. Gosh,
we only knew. I mean, if we go back, I'd buy Bitcoin 10 years ago. So
yeah,
I mean, I'd probably make some other changes, but you know,
this is the debate. This is the crypto debate of that's where we're going to have next time.
Yeah. Or would I not buy Bitcoin? Yeah. That's where we're going to go next time. All right, Justin, you're the man. I really appreciate your time, dude. Thank you so much.
This was really wonderful for me. Thanks, Matt.
Good. And for the rest of you, I'll see you next time. And until then, be good to each other.